Thank you very much, Barbara. Ralph Ansel is president of the Wilhelm Röpke Institute, which he founded in 1993 with Russell Kirk. It is located at the Franciscan University of Steubenville in Ohio.
Thank you very much. Well, Röpke has been mentioned, and Lenin has been mentioned. I will not depart from those precedents. Lenin said, when the time came to hang the capitalists, they would trip over each other to sell the communists the necessary rope. One is reminded of a similar recent case of a Canadian mining firm whose owner, in order to keep the business, worked with Castro and generously donated money to his young Communist League. And currently, we have the example of capitalists, including former high-ranking government officials, blithely trading with Communist China, despite its human rights violations and aggressive military buildup. What do these examples have in common? I think they illustrate the effect of actions based on self-interest alone, self-interest turned loose from any anchor in morality or community values, and thereby proving that it is not an adequate basis of either economic or social organization. Now, lest I be misunderstood, the solution, of course, is not to embrace some form of collectivism. Rather, it lies in limiting the sphere of legitimate market activity so that it harmonizes with the rest of the community, with other values, and indeed, as I hope to show, with itself. And it will be argued here that in a properly understood sense, market limitation is a logical necessity. It is akin to the problem of political liberty, which James Madison identified in Federalist Number 63 when he said, liberty may be endangered by the abuses of liberty as well as by the abuse of power. What is true of political liberty here is also true of economic liberty. To protect the market system against these destructive abuses, I'm urging a commitment to permanent values as required by market participants, both producers and consumers, in the form of what German economist Wilhelm Röpke called a terror regime of decency, and I hope that will become clear in due course. I want to emphasize three things then. One, the failures of pure self-interest approach to economic action. Two, the nature of the relationship between market activity and morality. And three, the question of the end state versus proceduralist views. The failures of a pure self-interest approach. In economics, we often call them social traps. A market economy is based on the assumption that the collective result of individuals pursuing their own self-interest is generally good. Adam Smith is famous for his dictum that we do not expect our meat from the benevolence of the butcher, but from a regard of his own self-interest. Precisely so. And for this reason, the market works so well. Yet the fact remains that this assumption is not always, in every case, valid. Many of the present policy problems today are the direct outgrowth of a dogmatized version of this truth maintained in the face of counterexamples that Adam Smith would be the first to recognize. Examples are not wanting, but I will comment on two or three. For instance, in a depression, as each employer tries to survive in the face of a diminishing demand, consulting only his self-interest, he lays off his employees. But if all or a large number of employers do that, total demand declines even more, and so requires still more layoffs. The collective result of the individual decisions is unwanted, even though each decision maker helped bring it about. We could also use the older case of a run on the bank, if this point is not clear enough yet. A healthy bank with a bad rumor that it was about to go out of business, one or two individuals withdraw their deposits, is not harmful. But if everybody or a large number suddenly do so, the collective result is disastrous for the bank and one that no one wanted. As a final example in this case, if we accept Talbot Page's analysis that entrepreneurs try to evade costs whenever they can, or as we say, externalize them, that they deliberately scan the horizon of property rights and look for cracks in which to dump their costs, we say they're trying to socialize them, even though, of course, they still try to privatize the benefits. This may mean passing costs off to the environment, to the general public, or to the taxpayer. Cost avoidance is arguably an important aspect of the firm's idea of efficiency, but it is not consistent with the economist's definition of efficiency, which requires that the price reflect all of the relative costs and benefits, and thus a higher product price may be the more efficient one. However, as each entrepreneur evades costs as he pursues only his own self-interest, the cost efficiency of his firm may go up, but as other firms follow suit, the efficiency of the market goes down. So let me wrap up this first point. If we are told and if we practice that we are to maximize our self-interest only in each specific transaction, and that we are not to look out for the other guy or the common good or other intangibles, then it is not surprising to see not only how the present failures described above came about, but how they are maintained. And if we further tell people, as one economist from George Mason University recently did to college students, that greed is the noblest of human motivations, then we cannot but help but believe that these failures will grow worse in both frequency and intensity. And the success of this propaganda may be the biggest market failure of them all. So this leads me to my second point. If pure self-interest is not always beneficial, if individually rational decisions can lead to a collectively irrational result, what am I getting at? I am arriving at the conclusion or the assertion that markets must presuppose moral values in order to work well. And fortunately, not all economists are so dogmatic as to insist that there is any difference here between a successful free market and adherence to moral values. The late Fred Hirsch, an economist who wrote for the British magazine The Economist, showed how the market economy succeeded being based on a pre-capitalist morality, which by its increasing orientation to self-interest at the expense of communal and public good also tended to undermine that foundation. In his words, the system, he says, operated on social foundations laid under a different order of society. But today, it erodes the social foundations that underlie a benign and efficient implementation of the self-interest principle operating through market transactions. The legacy of the past, of the pre-capitalistic past, was a legacy that had values that could be taken for granted at the time that Adam Smith was writing. But corrosive contact of active capitalist values, especially the anonymity of society, the greater and growing mobility of industrial society, tended to undermine that support. In his words again, the system has thereby lost outside support that was previously taken for granted by the individual. As individual behavior has been increasingly directed to individual advantage, habits and instincts based on communal attitudes and objectives have lost out. In other words, Hirsch sees another syndrome, another social trap, only this time it's not of a particular market or particular industry, but of the free market system itself. Now, there are undoubtedly many ways or avenues we could explore how this works, but I want to touch briefly on three of them. First, insofar as our national policy has been and is a commitment to endless or indefinite increases in per capita consumption, it has been a policy affirming and encouraging discontent. And while in times past there was good reason to be discontent with the economy, the danger lies in cultivating it as a habit of mind that's difficult, if not impossible, to limit just to economics. Instead, it spills over into the social and moral spheres. Secondly, correlated with increasing level of discontent is the technological change or impetus that this requires. Increasing per capita consumption is based on increasing per capita production, which is primarily based on changes in technology. If these changes are too rapid, if they are inappropriate, and in some cases, if they are flatly immoral, it renders not only our work skills continuously and more rapidly obsolete, which is itself demoralizing, but entire ways of life, including the continuity that we need as human beings, by remembering our past, by tradition, by the wisdom and experience of our parents and grandparents. And thus, individuals are increasingly left bobbing like a cork on an ocean of change without any stabilizing connections to an enduring community. And my third point, the increasing commercialization of all phases of life, arts, the sciences, sex, home, almost every phase, especially and most virulently incarnated in modern advertising, which appeals to and promotes our baser instincts, lust, ambition, greed, vanity, vulgarity. It can hardly be maintained that this continuous atmosphere of deracination leaves our characters unaffected. The ultimate danger is what the poet called the sinking in of the moral being that comes with a loss of faith that these forces work and make common cause with, a loss of faith in values, in virtue, in morals. And one result of this loss of faith, then, is a bitterness that people experience, and bitterness is always self-destructive. Now, like Hirsch, the German economist Wilhelm Röttger pointed out that 19th century capitalism failed to see that competition was not a harmless activity, either morally or psychologically, but was something, he argued, that had to be kept in bounds if one wanted to avoid poisoning the rest of society. The failure to understand this, he explained, was due to the peculiarly naive and optimistic belief, in his words, that a competitive market economy was an excellent moral academy, which by appealing to their self-interest encouraged men to be pacific and decent, as well as to practice all other civic virtues. While we know today, says Röttger, that competition reduces the moral stamina and therefore requires moral reserves outside the market economy. Years later, in his famous book, A Humane Economy, he repeats this same concern and stresses the ultimate moral support of the market economy lies outside the market. Market and competition are far from generating their moral prerequisites autonomously. These prerequisites must be furnished from outside. And it is, on the contrary, the market and competition which constantly strain them, draw upon them, and consume them. In figurative terms, it's like the explosive forces in the internal combustion engine. We want to keep that engine working, but only in those chambers. And even the engine occasionally needs tune-ups. And that means, among other things, that we ought to have a properly understood sense of an end state, of what the good society can be in this life. Not a utopian Marxian one, not a utopian libertarian one, but a realistic conception of how we should live. The opposers of end staters are called procedural liberals, who they ultimately do not apparently believe in the the objectivity of values or morals, but tend to pass them off as something purely subjective and relative either to individual preferences and tastes or to currently dominant but more or less ephemeral social prejudices and habits. Norman Berry succinctly summarizes the proceduralist this way. Procedural liberalism precludes the imposition on a political people without their consent of any political end state, including, of course, a liberal one. So the procedural liberal says it's okay to go to hell in a handcart so long as we do it the right way. Ultimately, this is surely a self-destructive bitterness that leads to nihilism. It is nihilistic, frankly, to be indifferent to whether the free market is preserved or not, whether free government is preserved or not. It is nihilistic and self-destructive to say that anything goes so long as it's done with free consent. It implies a kind of deification of man that claims that whatever he wills, collectively or individually, is all right, and there is nothing objective to judge it, to check it, to validate it, or condemn it. To use Repke's phrase in considering procedural liberals, he said that their view is an intransigent dogmatism which condemns itself to death with open eyes, a sort of gambling club whose rules include their own non-observance. This is the sort of lesson that we ought to have learned from the Weimar experience if we follow the German experience more fully. For while the Weimar Republic claimed that they had the freest constitution in the world, the totalistic commitment to this freedom ended up in totalitarianism. And the lesson was not lost upon other German thinkers who formed the Ordo liberal school of economics. They learned the basic lesson, namely that procedures and rules presuppose an enduring moral order. Otherwise, individuals will simply cheat on those rules in the familiar free rider sense. They therefore argued and concluded that sound legal and economic principles could not be left to the task of irrational political and spontaneous economic forces. They argued, as Walter Eucken says, that they must reject the arguments that exchange itself generates an appropriate moral welfare dimension. And they further believed, as he said, what experience of laissez-faire goes to prove is that the economic system cannot be left to organize itself. Now, what did they mean by this? They did not mean socialistic massive intervention in the economy, but they did mean that when contracts are engaged in which limit the freedom of others, such as to restrain competition, that it is a rightful case to intervene and forbid that, as we do in antitrust law. Thus, the lawyer Franz Lutz writes that this was only logical since it was based, in his words, on the legitimization of economic freedom in order to prevent this freedom from destroying its own prerequisites. In conclusion, then, the reason for many market and policy problems is the loss of those very basic beliefs and values that would most effectively support the market. This problem is not removed by resorting to orthodox economic techniques and concepts, or by denying that the problems exist, or by facile recommendations for government limitations and privatization. It is rather by a restoration of those values among market participants and policymakers, a restoration which begins with the admission that self-interest alone is self-destructive and proceeds to locate economic action in its proper place in the hierarchy of human goods and in the service of a vision of the good society properly understood. I close with Repke's friend Alexander Rustov's words, "The social market economy must be the relevant servant of humanity and of trans-economic values. All social, ethical, cultural, and human values are more important than the economy, and yet the economy must prepare the ground for their fullest development. For this reason, the economy must not take on forms which are incompatible with those trans-economic values." Our present economy, contrary to some rhetoric, is hardly in a form compatible with trans-economic values. And if we are not able or willing to recast it into such a form, we will not have to worry about communists hanging us with our own ropes. We will be doing it ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ralph. We have to conclude the program. We have to vacate the room for the hotel at this time.